Welcome back to The Fan. Lori Rubenson here with you. And certainly one of the pieces of news that came out on Sunday that the Nets would not be bringing back their interim head coach, PJ Carlissimo. After the loss in the first round to Chicago, the Nets now moving on. To talk about the Nets and how they move on, we bring in now Devin Carpertian. He's the managing editor, one of the founders of the Brooklyn Game blog, and going to talk about the Nets. Hey, how you doing, Devin?
Good. Hi, Lori. How you doing today?
I'm good, thank you. All right, so big picture, the Nets. I guess we start with the coaching situation. In your opinion, this isn't a matter of what did you expect on PJ Carlissimo, but in your opinion, following the Nets all season, did you feel like PJ Carlissimo did enough that he should have been brought back as head coach or not?
Well, that's kind of a difficult question because I don't think he was ever going to there was never really a shot at him coming back. There were just too many names in the off season that Brooklyn was interested in. They've always been kind of, you know, ever since this Brooklyn move has happened. And by the way, I heard you almost called them New Jersey Nets, and you should know better after a year, Lori. They've been there for a while.
I know. You know, I guess it's like calling Tampa Bay the Devil Rays. There are certain things that it's almost like muscle memory. something that just gets stuck in your brain and you can't help it.
Yeah, well, I'll find it in my heart to forgive you somewhere along the line. But no, I think, you know, Brooklyn has been a team that's been almost semi-obsessed with having some sort of image in the last few years, you know, especially with this whole move and rebranding. And PJ Carlissimo is just not the kind of name that's going to give you that type of image. Now, as far as what he did, frankly, I don't, you know, he's not somebody that did that much as a coach for the Nets. His entire mantra was basically staying the course that Avery Johnson laid out before him. And it led to the same end that Avery did.
Yeah. All right. So I I'm with you that I didn't think he was coming back. Now, of course, now that he's not, it leads to happy hunting season and all the names that are going to be tossed out there. You know, let's start with, I don't think Phil Jackson under these circumstances, I don't think he wants to come back and coach. And, you know, the Yankees now, you can tell it really is 125. The Nets clearly have locked up their GM. So, I don't think Phil Jackson is floating in. But in terms of, let's say, the other popular names that are out there, anything you're hearing or you think how likely that it is a Van Gundy maybe that's coming to help out the Nets?
I mean, it's definitely possible. You know, it's far too early in the chase or the search to really say anything definitive. Jeff Van Gundy himself has said he's not going to comment on it, even though, you know, the opportunity is available now. He said in the middle of the season that he never felt comfortable talking about a job that wasn't open. And even now that it is open, he's still saying, I'm not saying anything just yet. There were reports earlier today that seemed to indicate that he was not as interested in the job as originally reported. But I think it's obviously a possibility. I mean, you know, if Mikhail Prokhorov sees that Phil Jackson is not available for a coaching position and Jeff Van Gundy is his next top guy, Mikhail Prokhorov has a lot of money and doesn't really care how he spends it. So if that's the guy he wants, he will give him a blank check. It all comes down to what the short list for Brooklyn is. I think Jeff Van Gundy is on that list. I think there are a couple other guys around the league that are also on that list should Van Gundy decide he doesn't want to come back. And I agree with you about Phil Jackson. He doesn't seem like he wants to come back in a coaching capacity, though he could come back in some sort of advisor or presidential capacity in the front office, kind of, you know, steering the culture of a team as opposed to coaching it. It's still very early. I mean, the Nets clearly wanted to make it seem, you know, wanted people to know that the coaching position was available. They barely, you know, the rust had barely gotten off the season before they announced that PJ was gone. I think we'll probably find something out pretty substantive in the next couple of weeks. But, you know, right now it's all up in the air.
Let me ask you a different kind of question. You know, aside from who might they be interested in, what about who should they be interested in terms of the kind of coach? Watching this group of players and knowing that they can't make a ton of changes to the personnel, what sort of coach do you think they need to move this team forward?
You know, I think they Honestly, one of my favorite names for them to look at is a guy named Brian Shaw. He's the assistant coach for the Indiana Pacers. He was an assistant under Phil Jackson with the Los Angeles Lakers. He knows the triangle offense. I think the triangle would be a very interesting offense to put in with a guy like Deron Williams and Joe Johnson and Brooke Lopez, that kind of tandem. He's a guy who would be a first-time head coach, and Billy King has said today that he would not be averse to having a guy who's a first-time head coach. I mean, his team just got beat by Tom Thibodeau, who was the first-time head coach of the Chicago Bulls. So I think, you know, that's a very interesting name that's floated out there. You know, Deron Williams and Reggie Evans both said today also that they think they need someone experienced, which would kind of fly in the face of getting a first-time coach. But again, a guy like Shaw is somebody who's very respected around the league, and it would be the type of name that may not be a huge splash a la Phil Jackson, but somebody who's definitely got something to prove as a coach and somebody who could really turn this team around and kind of fix all the little problems that never really got taken care of this year.
Now, as you say, is Brian Shaw a sexy enough name for ownership who's looking to, take some of the back page appeal away from the Knicks in this marketplace?
Well, that's the big question. I mean, I'm not really sure that he is. And if that's the case, you know, you're going to go with somebody like Jeff Van Gundy, or you're going to try to find somebody who has some sort of name and connectivity. But the thing about the back pages in this town is that it all comes down to wins. If they win more than the New York Knicks, they're going to eventually take over that market, especially now that they're in Brooklyn. And, you know, if they have a coach who's good enough that's going to bring them those type of victories, a guy like a Tom Thibodeau or a Doc Rivers, or if Brian Shaw is that guy, then that guy – you know, that's going to be the most important thing above all else. I mean, everything else will write itself. Deron Williams is going to be a star under, no matter what coach it is. Brooke Lopez has advanced in ways that I don't think anybody expected this year, And if he continues to progress, that's going to become the story. And if they can win and if they can take over this market and if they can, match the Knicks in a way that they, only kind of started to do this year and, really started to kind of take that ground a little bit. But if they can catapult themselves beyond the Knicks next year, it's not going to matter who their coach is.
We're on with Devin Karpertian, managing editor of Brooklyn Game blog. And, you mentioned that a couple of the veteran guys, the star guys, the highest paid guys, and Joe Johnson and Deron Williams were saying that they would prefer that they want a veteran coach, an experienced coach. Given the way the season ended, how much input do you think those guys have to the next coach? Given the way things didn't end up going in the playoffs.
I mean, I think they're obviously going to have some sort of say in it. I mean, they probably won't have the final say. It'll probably come down to Billy King and Prokhorov and the negotiations between whoever it is that they want and how much they're willing to pay. But obviously, I mean, look, they need an offense that's going to be able to maximize the talents of their best players. And the offense they had this season just wasn't bad. So I think more than anything else, if they find somebody who's creative enough, with that kind of, who can implement a sort of offensive system that's good enough so that the entire team can, play to a level that they really only did in spurts this year. That I think is going to matter above all else. And obviously, Joe and Deron are going to have some sort of input on what coach is going to be able to do that for their talents. So I think obviously there's going to be some, there's going to be some discussion, but at the end of the day, I still think it's going to be Billy King's call and Mikhail Prokhorov's call. It was Prokhorov's call to fire Avery Johnson. I presume it was his call to let go of PJ Carlesimo, and I think it's going to be the same thing again.
When you look at this series versus the Bulls from, a guy who clearly is very passionate about the Brooklyn Nets, which game, when you think about it in the off season, which game is going to sting and sit worse with you? Is the lasting memory going to be the Game 7 loss, or is it going to be the triple overtime loss?
I would probably go with the Game 4 loss, but you're also underselling Game 3. At one point in the second quarter, for 13 minutes, they shot 1-for-25. And that is that was their worst stretch of the entire playoffs. The triple overtime loss stings because they should have won that game. Nate Robinson went on a tear like only Nate Robinson can apparently do. And at some point, if he's hitting one-handed bang shots from 22 feet out, there's really not much you can do to stop that. There's just some sort of destiny. So that stung in the sense that the Nets should have won that game and gave it away. But what really stung is that the execution in Game 3, the execution in Game 7, the things that they should have done and didn't do, you know, that stings more to me than, you know, a kind of random chance of Nate Robinson throwing up the best game of his career.
Now, do you subscribe to the theory that, you know, looking at a Game 7, that there's something about this Nets team that they were not mentally tough enough or didn't have enough fire, didn't have enough passion, whatever it is, when you compare to the Bulls? Do you look at that as being a problem and something that you think needs to be fixed in the offseason?
You know, I think that's one of those things where you kind of reverse engineer a story. You know, if they'd won that game, you'd hear about how their cool confidence, you know, led them through against a team that was just, you know, yelling a little bit too much. I mean, look, Carlos Boozer can yell after every dunk he wants, but if they lose games, it's not going to look important. I think what's most important for this team, and the reason they lost, is that they didn't execute. They played a smarter team. They played a team that was better prepared for them. They played a team that, you know, had a defensive system in place that was very clearly defined from the outset, one of the best defensive systems in the league, and they fell back on a very predictable offense and couldn't produce the points when necessary to take important leads and hold on to them throughout the course of the series. You know, they were Joe Johnson shooting 5 of 14 away from winning this series. They were a Nate Robinson explosion away from winning this series. Sometimes things like this happen, but they happen because you're not preparing yourself. You're not setting yourself up for success. So that, to me, I think is the most important part. I think the whole idea of whether or not they have enough heart, whether or not they have enough passion in them, I think all that stuff is just a little bit too overblown. And the important thing is having a system in place, you know, from your coaching staff, from your team, you know, something that you have, you know, you can fall back and have confidence in, and the Nets just didn't have that this season.
Yeah, it's interesting, is coming out of the Knicks loss on Sunday, there's some of the commentary was about, well, we got outworked and outplayed. And the particularly funny comment to me is the outplayed one. Well, of course you got outplayed. You lost, you know? I mean, yeah. I always love that line after a team loses a game. Well, we got outplayed. Yeah. You got outplayed. Yeah, you lost.
Yeah, I asked Darren Williams before the series, you know, what do you guys have to do to win this? And he said, score more points than they do. You know, sometimes it just comes down to that.
Speaking of Darren Williams and score more points, is what was your take with the game, you know, the last minutes of the game when it seemed like both Darren Williams and Brook Lopez were deferring to Joe Johnson, hoping it would be Joe Johnson who would take and hit that big shot. Were you disappointed that it seemed like neither one of those two all-star players in Darren Williams and Brook Lopez were wanting to take that big shot?
You know, that wasn't terribly disappointing to me, in all honesty. I think a couple of the issues with, you know, people wanted Brook Lopez to take an 18-footer, but he found Joe Johnson for an open three-pointer. And you, at some point, you know, Joe Johnson has been this team's, you know, crutch in the fourth quarter. They've gone to him late games and important games. He's hit two buzzer-beating game winners for them. I think he was 10 for 12 on the season within 30 seconds if the game was within one possession. I mean, he's been this team's go-to scorer in the last 30 seconds of the game. You know, if you want Brook to shoot a mid-range jumper, that's one thing. But if he can find Joe Johnson for an open three, I don't care if Joe has been shooting 1 for 13. You want to find him that shot, you know. Over the course of the season, that stuff is going to work out for you. Now, it didn't work out for them in Game 7. And, you know, to see Darren Williams – I mean, Darren Williams, I thought, played a lot better down the stretch than I think some people gave him credit for. Mm-hmm. He finished the game with 24 points. He had, I think he added 7 assists and 6 rebounds. He was attacking the rim, throughout a big stretch of the fourth quarter. He helped bring them, not single-handedly, but very, very close to single-handedly, helped bring them back into this game with his all-around effort on the offensive end. I think he played a great game. He was not the reason this team lost this game. And, you know, you trust Joe Johnson in those situations. Even if, you know, you ride with him and you die with him. And on Game 7, they died with him.
When, you know, this team looks forward, given the salary cap and the limitations and the big contracts and what they have, what kind of personnel changes would you be looking to make? You know, what we've heard the owner even say, hey, you know, thinks maybe they're a player away. With Chris Humphries' expiring contract, with whatever it is, what kind of player would you be looking to kind of round out and finish out this team?
You know, it's hard to really know what's available. At this point, I think it's very, you know, their issues are very clear. They need a starting caliber power forward. You know, Reggie Evans is a lot of fun to have, but he's not somebody who needs to be starting. They need to have more athleticism in their front court. They're not a very athletic team. That was evident against, you know, Joakim Noah, who's getting offensive rebounds like candy, especially in that game seven. They need some more explosiveness in their backcourt. You know, they need to have a set rotation where they can go to a backup small forward. A lot of times this year they were just kind of shuffling between rotations, figuring out if Keith Bogans was the guy or Jerry Stackhouse was the guy or Marshawn Brooks was the guy, and they need to figure out just exactly what player they need to have there. But I do think the number one priority is getting someone to flank Brooke Lopez who can kind of, you know, make up for some of his defensive mistakes, give enough on the offensive end that Reggie Evans just, you know, can't do. And to find that player is going to be difficult. I mean, there's not a lot of players available. They don't have the assets or the cap space to get Josh Smith. Their assets right now are basically Chris Humphries, who, like you said, his contract is expiring, which has its own value. Marshawn Brooks, a couple of first rounders. They have the 22nd pick in this year's draft. You know, so it's hard to say just how they're going to be able to fill that hole, but it is an important one, and it's something that they're going to need to fill if they really want to improve on this season.
Well, it sounds like they may need to get a little lucky with the draft or something where, somehow a Keith Fareed type of player magically falls to them. And I don't see that in this year's draft, but you never know. Mm-hmm. Really, Devin Karpertian from thebrooklyngame.com, really appreciate the time. And certainly if there's any Nets activities during the offseason, we'll catch up with you again.
Sounds good, Laura. Thanks for having me.